Sometimes historic events suck. But what shouldn't suck is learning about history. I do that through storytelling. History That Doesn't Suck is a chart-topping history-telling podcast chronicling the epic story of America decade by decade. Right now, I'm digging into the history of incredible infrastructure projects of the 1930s, including the Hoover Dam, the Empire State Building, the Golden Gate Bridge, and more. The promise is in the title. History That Doesn't Suck. Available on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
B. Mitch and Finley, 106.7 The Fan. Excited to get on the Rude Guest Hotline. Rude makes the most reliable HVAC products in the DMV. And talk to our friend Barry Sferluga, Washington Post sports columnist. Barry, what's up, dude? How are you?
JP, doing well. Hope you're doing well as well.
Yeah, man. My oldest won a lacrosse tournament this weekend. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, congrats.
Yeah, dude. There's a lot to discuss. I made notes for our discussion because I don't want to forget anything. I think we start with the Nats. They had a good weekend. They could use a good weekend. They had one. The Orioles did not. Where are we at with this Nationals club?
You know, I was thinking going into this weekend that this is not a good place to be. Like they talked about rebuild fatigue in spring training, and I think the fan base has it, and I think there are pieces on the roster that make you encouraged not only about the future, but it should, you know, hopefully make you encouraged about the present. And it was not playing out that way. They lost, you know, I think 7 in a row. That ended with a win in the Braves series, but they did lose 3 out of 4 in that. And it felt to me like, are we getting close to a shakeup here? And then they go in and they not only sweep the Orioles, but they win a tight one on Friday night and take 7-0 leads in the two weekend games and really kind of show their potential for offensive dynamics. I mean, 5 homers yesterday, 2 by CJ Abrams, James Wood has 11, I think, maybe it's 12 now. Those guys are both in the top 15 in all of baseball in OPS. So you're starting to see some signs at a time when I felt like you really needed to see some signs. So it'll be interesting to see whether they can carry that momentum into the homestand that starts with the Braves tomorrow.
Dude, and after what happened to the Braves, what happened with them at the hands of the Braves last week, I think Atlanta, what'd they take, 3 of the 4?
3 out of 4.
And, you know, Atlanta's turned it around and is playing much better baseball. What'd they start, like 0-6, 0-7 or something? And now they're
started
over 500.
0-7, yeah.
Yeah. I think rebuild fatigue is a really good way to phrase what's going on with the Nats. I think it's, for me, it's ownership fatigue. It's, these dudes said they were going to sell it. Everybody got excited. Now they're not. What the hell's going on there? Abrams playing well, Wood playing well. You know, there are things to be excited about, but it's like, where, I don't know that there's a light at the end of the tunnel. I don't even know if we're in the tunnel.
So, I mean, I obviously tie everything back to ownership, but at some point they have said, you know, we're holding on to this thing. Now, I've said this before. I mean, they're holding on to it until and unless somebody gives them, you know, the X, whatever the X is, more than $2.5 billion that they thought was worth selling it for. But if the ownership is going to stay in place, and it appears right now there's no end date on that, then it's up to the people that ownership has hired and is sticking with to make it work. And it's not all about Major League payroll, although that's a factor. Like, you have to go out and buy players like you did when you had an awesome run from 2012 to 2019. But it's also about drafting and development that has frankly not been up to the level that it needs to be to fill out a roster that is competitive. The best players on their big league roster, almost without exception, are players acquired in trade. James Wood and CJ Abrams and Mackenzie Gore from the Juan Soto trade. Kevin Ruiz, who is coming back with a pretty solid season behind the plate after a disastrous 2024, was in the Scherzer Trey Turner trade to LA. They just are not drafting and developing impact players at the major league level at the rate necessary to build a core of that is a contender that you add then free agents too. So I think it's a, you know, there's a kind of a wide angle view of the organization that of course makes ownership the most important element, but you really have to look into the last decade of who have they developed into big league stars. Really the last major league star they developed was Anthony Rendon, and he was taken in the 2012 draft, I believe.
Wow. That's an indictment. That I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that also doesn't sound like the most bullish take on Dylan Cruz.
Oh, you know, I mean, I'm not down on him. He's, you know, he's not a star. I have always thought with him and you know, look, I didn't scout him at LSU. I'm not a scout. But he feels like, if you talk to people, that he is a high floor guy, not a high ceiling guy. And that can be a good thing if you are a plus major league player. And he certainly is defensively and likely will be offensively. You know, he may not be, and I don't think he is, Bryce Harper, but I if he's a, you know, 10-year regular solid contributor to your team, then that's fine. They have coming up, I mean, Dylan Cruz was taken with the second pick in the draft 2 years ago.
Right.
They have the number one pick in the draft coming up. And this has to be an impact player. There are a few, I don't know the baseball draft inside and out, but there are a few players in contention for that top spot. The rise of this franchise was really built around 2-1-1s in Strasburg and Harper. Yeah. In 2009 and 2010. You got to get that one right, and you have to have it added to a core that I'm not trying to be down on them overall, because I think, you know, Jake Irvin is a guy that they drafted and developed, that a lower round pick that is coming through for them. They're not like, oh, for the world, but it has to start happening at more a high frequency, and that 1-1 pick has to be part of that pool.
For sure. Talking with our friend Barry Svrluga here on the Rude Guest Hotline. You can give Barry a follow at Barry Svrluga, Svrluga, on Twitter and Instagram. let's switch to the Caps. I thought whoever won Caps Canes would get to the Stanley Cup. We'll see if that ends up happening. The Panthers are obviously a formidable opponent in the Eastern Conference Finals. But the way the NHL playoffs are structured, you're going to play a divisional opponent in the second round every year. And for Washington, that likely means Carolina. That this Carolina team doesn't appear to be going anywhere. Brendan Moore is not going anywhere. Their coach that has that very specific system. I think we've seen the Commanders this offseason try to better compete with Philly, specifically by adding so much on the offensive line. Do the Caps have to try to combat the Hurricanes?
That's a really interesting way of thinking of it, and I hadn't thought of it that way. I mean, they definitely have a Carolina problem, and you're right about the weird way that NHL has its playoffs configured at the moment is, you know, the top team, the top seed in the East plays the lowest wild card, regardless of what division it comes from. But then when you get to the next round, you're going back in division if you're the, you know, the top team advances. So they were going to get the winner of that Carolina-New Jersey series. Carolina got rid of Jersey in five games. They looked really good doing it. They looked really good in beating the Caps in Raleigh during the Ovechkin goal chase. They beat them 5-1 there. And they do play a structure that the Capitals find really difficult to combat. And I think, you know, Spencer Carberry said this after game five, and he was giving the Canes all the credit in the world. Like, the core of that group, Sebastian Aho and Jordan Staal and those guys have been through it. They've been in the playoffs 7 years in a row under Brendan Moore. That's only two teams I think have longer streaks, postseason streaks, that haven't been broken. So they have learned in those small moments how important everything is. And I thought when Carberry said that, I was like, oh man, like, you've got Alex Ovechkin and John Carlson and Tom Wilson with like a bazillion years of experience doing this as well. But then if you go down the roster, it doesn't compare. I mean, Carolina is just a much more postseason seasoned team. So I think, I think the positive takeaway from the Caps postseason experience is that they had it. They got 10 more games. They learned. I mean, you can go into a bunch of little moments where they didn't come through. They failed to clear a puck and couldn't get a line change. Carolina's coming after him, keeping it in the zone, and they break through for a goal. I mean, that's kind of what they do, and they have. Carberry said the Caps have to learn how big those small moments are, and that was, you know, Alex Alexiev, and I can't remember who else was out there, but guys who aren't Wilson and Ovi, who have done it a million times. So I just think that the entirety of the Caps season has to be viewed as a positive because of not only the Ovechkin chase, which was really, really cool to get it done this year, but because, you know, a lot of people didn't even have them in the playoffs, and they were a front runner in the Eastern Conference from day one. They were really, really good. And I think it's, you know, there's a developing core that is ready to make another run at it again next year.
Sometimes historic events suck. But what shouldn't suck is learning about history. I do that through storytelling. History That Doesn't Suck is a chart-topping history-telling podcast chronicling the epic story of America decade by decade. Right now, I'm digging into the history of incredible infrastructure projects of the 1930s, including the Hoover Dam, the Empire State Building, the Golden Gate Bridge, and more. The promise is in the title, History That Doesn't Suck. Available on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I want to switch to golf, but quickly on the Caps. I wasn't there for game, what was that, five. We were at the beach. But I had multiple people sending me photos of empty seats. Were you at the game?
Yeah.
Was that accurate? Because that can always be like kind of twisted, I would say.
It wasn't. I would say it's accurate. It wasn't like big sections were not full. It was like you could say, like, you could look and be like, oh, there's a little cluster of six seats over there that's not full. And I would say, I know I talked to somebody who was going and I hadn't checked the prices myself, but they said, you know, ticket prices are dropping before game five. And if you think about it, it's against an opponent that, unlike Pittsburgh or Boston or New York or whatever, you're not selling it to any out of town fans, or not many anyway.
If
you're a Caps fan, like, game five, nothing can be decided in a positive way. Like, you should go and support your team. But if it comes back for game seven, I don't think you'd see those empty seats. You know what I mean? It's like, it's just a weird little hole in the market that probably makes it not super attractive for a Caps fan.
I agree with that. All right. Talking with our friend Barry Svrluga here on the Rude Guest Hotline. Rude makes the most reliable heating and air conditioning products in the DMV. Let's talk about the golf this weekend. Three players and people really stood out to me most. I think we start with the winner in Scottie Scheffler and what he's been able to accomplish. I'm out on, like, who we're comparing him to and predicting how many more majors and all that. Just right now, he's an absolutely fantastic golfer.
I mean, he's the best on the planet. And I know Rory won the Masters, but I think Scotty reestablished himself with no questions. I mean, he was so calm when things were falling apart. That's probably his superpower. But he also you just look at the shots he hits. It's so impressive how high, how far, how accurate his short game. He's got a great, great demeanor. He's now won. I think it's important that he won a major that wasn't the Masters. So he's got another leg of the career Grand Slam checked off. And he is a player that, you know, you never really want to, you know, say, well, that guy could win the career Grand Slam because it's happened only seven times. But that guy could win the career Grand Slam. I mean, he'll be the favorite going into Oakmont, and there's nothing he doesn't do well. And now he's done it over a long enough period of time that includes other wins, like, you know, the Olympic gold medal and other big tournaments that at 28, I just think that it's weird to say that a guy who's played this good, this high a level of golf going back to when he won his first major at the Masters a few years ago. I think his best stretch could be the next decade. You know, 28 to 38 is a really nice mix of still having the athletic ability and all the shots that a golfer needs, but also having the experience and knowing how to get it done. He learned, you know, that will go down as a blowout yesterday, but we all know it was tied after 11 holes, and he had to pull himself back together against, you know, a formidable major champion on the other side.
Totally. And the other, so properly crediting Scotty, he's the best. The way he closed, honestly, in a, I don't know, an hour long span of time, the way that that horse journalism closed in the Preakness was incredible to watch. And I don't pretend to be a big horse racing guy. I watch the Triple Crown. But the speed that horse showed over the last, I don't know, 50 yards, 100 yards, furlong, whatever the measurement is. And then the way Scotty closed Saturday night with like birdie, birdie, par, par, birdie, birdie, or whatever it was just incredible. But the dude that pushed him on Saturday was John Rahm. And I thought Rahm's play and then inability to kind of finish, and then his comments after about this is the most fun I've had playing golf in a long time. I just feel like whatever, and we've got Liv coming to town in a couple weeks, but like when the best player on your tour is openly kind of miserable about it, it just, it felt like such huge commentary to me.
Well, I think he kind of very transparently regrets the decision to go to Liv. And if you remember the circumstances that he went, I mean, he had great quotes about, you know, I talked to my wife, like, how much money do you actually need? Like, what if at some point the difference between X million, X hundred million and X plus 200 million is like, how does that really impact our life? And I think ultimately the number became too large that you're, you know, going to be able to support generations and generations of your family. But he talked from the minute he got out there, like, I miss going to regular PGA Tour stops like Riviera and Torrey, where he had great memories and good results. And then you're totally right that those comments accurately reflect what he wants to do. Legacy is important to him, and you can't right now establish any sort of legacy on the LIV Tour. You could win 10 LIV events in a row, and it's not enhancing your legacy as a professional golfer. The other thing I would say about Rahm is I don't think it should be written that he collapsed over the last final few holes, because he lipped out or barely missed like three or four putts in a row from like 11 to 14 that would have put pressure on Scotty. And then because he was playing ahead and he's running out of holes, he had to be hyper aggressive if he wanted to try to win. All he cares about is winning the golf tournament. So somebody said, like, the shot on 17, the par three that he like overcooked over the flag and it went in the bunker, I mean, in the water and led to double bogey. Like, he's doing that because he's trying to hit it to 2 feet and make a tap in birdie and put some pressure on Scotty. He doesn't care about sliding to a tie for eighth instead of a tie for fourth and whatever the, you know, millions of dollars of difference it is there. Like, he cares about legacy and major championships. And that's, I think that's why he really probably has fun playing golf now 4 times a year and only 4 times a year.
Yeah. He's not worried about his FedEx points or any of that. You know,
right.
And I applaud him for that. It's interesting too, that if it's not Rahm, then Bryson is Liv's biggest star. And Bryce is a great player. I'm fascinated to see what he does at Oakmont, but he was never really in this. And then his comments after, jeez, dude. He's like, I got to find a new golf ball. I got to find new equipment. It's like, dog, you got outplayed. Just shut up.
Well, please. Yeah, it's two major Sundays in a row. You know, he was in the final group with Rory at Augusta, and in fact, you know, it was tied with him after the first hole, after Rory doubled the first hole, and then he just kind of went away. Like, he was not part of the story. And I feel like that's kind of his Sunday at the PGA. He, you know, he's a 2-time U.S. Open champion. He can play that kind of golf. Oakmont is not too much for him, but it's not a golf ball, man. Like you got to make the shots. You got to execute. It's not YouTube golf. He's perfectly capable of doing it. And I think in some ways, man, I like Rahm as a player and as a character better than Bryson, but I think Bryson is probably Liv's biggest star at this point, just because of the YouTube factor and all the stuff he does on there. Like he's really well known in a way that Rahm isn't.
Yeah, no, totally. Last thing, and I feel like you're uniquely positioned to answer this. There was a kind of a controversy, maybe a controversy. So Rory McIlroy's driver tested positive, I guess, for being illegal. I don't know if I'm overstating that. Non-conforming, I guess, is the term. Rory didn't talk to the media all 4 days of the tournament in Charlotte. Rory didn't play his best, didn't drive the ball his best. I don't want to over. What do we make of all that?
Well, here's the thing, man, and I am not a stickler for, oh, if you don't talk to sports writers or do a post-round interview, that makes you a bad person. I just have never been in that camp, and I think there are times when if someone storms off or doesn't talk, it says more than that what they would say in the interview because it shows how pissed they are. But it is egregious for the most recent major champion and one of the stars in the sport, one of the very, very few that could transcend golf and be kind of a mainstream sports star, to blow it off for 4 straight days it reflects very poorly on him and his understanding of his place in the game. And it, to me, it's not even about the driver head, because that could have been diffused in 2 questions. It's not a big deal.
Right, like Scotty's tested positive too, right?
And yeah, you have these rules, and guys or equipment companies are trying to max out their equipment, and they're all checked beforehand. And if it's not like you got caught, it's just like, no, you can't play that one. You have to switch to another one. So he not only makes a small story bigger, because now whenever he plays next, he's going to have to be asked about that, but he's the 4 days in a row thing. I mean, people can criticize Tiger Woods for being a boring interview and not saying much after you know, excellent rounds. He did it. He never skipped it. The only time he didn't talk was when he was walking off the course with an injury. And I just think it's poor judgment on Rory's part. And it's delicate because it sounds like a whiny sports writer being like, well, you didn't give me a quote for my story. It's a bigger issue than that. It's like you don't only talk when things are going well. You talk in all circumstances. You alone, this isn't a team sport, can explain what you found difficult about a course that you've owned over the course of your career, where you got your first PGA Tour victory, what didn't work, where are you with your game, like what's your outlook for the rest of the summer. That's on Rory McIlroy to explain about Rory McIlroy. And when he doesn't, it's just, I think it's poor form.
I don't always care when they blow it off, but this one seemed egregious to me too. There's a bigger conversation of what athletes owe the media, and at some point, I don't know that will ever get settled, but it is an interesting concept for you and I to discuss, because we are the media, but like I also see their side of it. Right now, though, I'm way, way late, and I've taken up too much of your time. So will you go to Congressional at all this week?
I am, yeah, definitely on Sunday, maybe once before then.
Okay, I might go Wednesday if you're interested.
We can all right, well, on. Yeah, we'll catch up.
The great Barry's for Luga joining us. Thanks, buddy.
Thanks, man. Talk to you soon.
Give him a follow at Barry's for Luga, Svrluga. Barry joining us via the Rude Guest Hotline. Going to switch to some Commanders football next.
Sometimes historic events suck. But what shouldn't suck is learning about history. I do that through storytelling. History That Doesn't Suck is a chart-topping history-telling podcast chronicling the epic story of America decade by decade. Right now, I'm digging into the history of incredible infrastructure projects of the 1930s, including the Hoover Dam, the Empire State Building, the Golden Gate Bridge, and more. The promise is in the title, History That Doesn't Suck. Available on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.